There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
Welcome, most honored and august listeners, to our penultimate entry in our Directors in Short Pants series. We shall reverently discuss the first effort of one of the titans of cinema, Akira Kurosawa, and his martial arts opus, Sanshiro Sugata. This film deals with the age-old conflict between the students of jujitsu and the students of judo. Jujitsu is an ancient Japanese martial art whose origins can be found in the 8th century. As our illustrious listeners surely know, do is the Japanese word for way, so judo translates as the way of the Jew, and has its origins in New York's Lower East Side.
No, it doesn't!
This is why judo's form of combat is often described as wholesale slaughter. Judo has a number of distinct styles. Smoked salmon style, gefilte fish style, such a nice brisket I've got for you style, and many others. Conflict between the two martial arts was inevitable, as jujitsu masters consider bagels to be unclean, and judo masters wonder, such a fuss, why not just sit and have a nice glass tea? One can only imagine how the great Kurosawa brings his unique style and flair to such a conflict. Join us now and find out. I am your most unworthy host, Max, Way of the Forgetful Marmoset Levine, and over there, just emerging from his Zen trance, is Mike, Way of the Reciprocating Hamster Loose. Some arugula you would like, maybe, Mike?
Max can only say that because I'm gay. Anyway. Wow, I honestly fell for that. It's like, is he going to do an opening that's that dry? And okay, judo.
What are you saying about my arugula? You say my arugula is dry?
I hate that green leafy
stuff. It really tends to be.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Way of the Jew.
Yeah, but before we get into the
Jewish
way.
Such a hit I took.
Yes. Arrow, let my people go. Hiya!
I'd rather have seen that movie.
Oh, it is the Pharaoh. Fortunately, I know judo, which my cheapskate husband wouldn't pay for.
There's our Flintstones reference. Let's move on to the thing.
Yes, we asked you last week about our
poll question.
And we wanted to know.
Way of the Jew. Sorry.
What it says.
No, it doesn't. I just peeked.
I'd like to know what judo means to anyone else. The poll question was, who is your favorite female cinematic character? And leading off, we have Dave.
Who will probably be able to tell you what judo means, but go ahead.
Yeah, of course he does. No, he studies karate.
But he still speaks Japanese.
Well, he'll tell you he does. If he says judo means something else, he's making it up. Dave says, tough call. For character acting, I think the old lady parts give the most freedom to the actress.
I don't want to talk about old lady parts.
Oh, no. Oh! Now that's in my head. Thank you. So, Margaret Rutherford's Jane Marple, Maggie Smith's Violet Crawley, from Downton Abbey. Mm. And I love what Helen Mirren has been doing recently, Mobland, 1923. I don't know this one. Helen Mirren's doing a mob series? Okay, gotta check this out.
Cool.
Judi Dench in anything. Such a clever little Judi Dench. But her M was a refreshing take on a tired role.
Yep, sure was.
Yeah. For younger, I suppose Myrna Loy's Nora Charles, Katharine Hepburn's Susan Vance, and Greta Garbo's Ninotchka. Oh, yeah. Those are all amazing. For action, Sigourney Weaver's Ripley. Ooh, can't argue there.
Yeah.
I think Japan has a much wider range of quality female roles in its cinema. Really? Iwashi Tashima in Yakuza Wives, for example, or her role in Ballad of Oren. Oh, she was much better in that. I have not. Actually, Iwashi Tashima in anything, and she seems to be in everything.
Oh,
okay,
that's easy.
Fuji Junko in Red Peony Gambler. Okay, I've heard that title.
Wow, there. I'm proud of you.
Yeah, for a chivalrous action hero. Actually, Fuji Junko in anything, including after she married and changed her name. but he's not going to tell us what her new name is. Thanks a lot, Dave. Asano Atsuko in The Geisha for a beauty with a complicated character. For action, Matsuyama Yoko in the Crimson Bat series. See, for Catwoman!
No!
It's the same thing, practically.
Not even close. Wow, this episode's going to be weird.
And for martial arts, Shiomi Atsuko. The Great Chase is a fun one for Shiomi Atsuko, but she also did Sister Street Fighter. Wow, thanks, Dave. That's quite a plethora.
Yeah.
I'm really interested to find out about these Japanese action heroes. Aaron Perez simply says, Trinity from The Matrix, because she's, I hope I can pronounce this, sexy. It's like six X's.
Yeah. Boy, and you're...
Yes, she is.
You're batting zero this week. Go ahead.
Hey, that's up from last week. Keith Wright says, I feel bad for what I'm about to write because Dave Mackman just opened the library. I love Pam Grier in just about anything, but she was so good in Jackie Brown. Mm-hmm. I also love Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn because she cracks me up. She was fantastic in I, Tonya. Yes, she was. Great movie. Allison Janney, Angela Bassett, and Alfred Woodard are three of my favorites. Angela in Strange Days and Alfred in pretty much anything. She was kick-ass in that Star Trek Generations movie. Borg sounds Swedish. Not as comprehensive as David, but that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you, Keith. He went more for the actors rather than the characters, but yeah. So did Dave, really, but that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, Dave covered it by saying in almost anything, so...
Yeah.
That's fine.
Dr. Professor Rebecca Pelkey says, I'm a big fan of Eowyn. She was a quiet sort of badass. True.
Yeah.
She also is Kaylee from Firefly / Serenity, another atypical strong character in an understated way. You will find many on the internet to agree with you. Kelly Cooper says, I'm not super coherent right now. Oh, no. Kryptonite.
Kalganite.
Yeah. But one of my favorites is Regina Reggie Lampert from Charade.
Oh, yeah.
As played by the amazing Audrey Hepburn. Bewildered and anxious, but brave, chatty, clever, and food-obsessed.
Although she doesn't eat anything. That poor woman weighs about 25 pounds.
Would you like a sandwich, Mrs. Lambert? Of course, I love Ripley from Alien. Another one for Ripley. If The Dead Don't Die had been about Tilda Swinton's Zelda Winston, it might have been a watchable movie instead of a boring, disappointing fest.
Oh,
yeah, I'll give you that. I absolutely will agree with you there. Yim Bing Chun, as played by Michelle Yeoh in Wing Chun, is one of my role models. Well, it's Michelle Yeoh, of course.
I know, right?
Brave, smart, and clever, but still romantic. Charlize Theron's characters in any of her badass roles. Oh, yeah. Atomic Blonde, The Old Guard, absolutely. Oh, and Furiosa.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and Sania Nanyua blew me away as Melanie in The Girl with All the Gifts. Huh. Okay. It's a zombie movie.
Oh, didn't see it.
Charles Forsyth says, Margaret from Liquid Sky popped into my head. Ooh, never saw that.
Me either. I saw Vanilla Sky. Is that close?
Different flavor. Oh. But I'll have to go with Ellen Ripley. There you go. Fun fact, when the script was written, the character was just Ripley. It didn't become a she named Ellen until they cast Sigourney Weaver.
Oh.
I think that is one of the reasons why she's such a great character. She wasn't written with any of the women character tropes. Good point, Charles.
Yeah, written by a guy.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, she's a biggie.
And... strap in, because that loquacious fellow from the Emerald Isle, Bill O'Lading, has come in with his, quote, as God is my witness, they're not going to lick me.
Ew.
Ew. Oh, wait, that's the... I'm going to live through this, and when it's all over, I'll never be hungry again. No, nor any of my folk. If I have to lie, steal, cheat, or kill, as God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again.
As God is my witness, I swore turkeys could fly.
There are many evocative female cinematic characters in cinema who set out to get what they want, no matter what the cost. Dorothy Gale... Dorothy Gale, really?
Well, she does have to go and kill a wicked witch.
Mm. Yeah, I never thought of her as particularly brutal that way, but I guess.
Oh, really? See our entire episode on The Wizard of Oz where you claim that she's a murderer.
Well, she is, and she made that poor munchkin hang himself on set.
No, that didn't happen. It's an emu.
That's what they want you to think.
Hey, I've Dorothy seen Gale, it.
Eve Harrington, Rose DeWitt Bucater, at all the A Star Is Born leads, but I'll go with a problematic one. Gone with the Wind, oh boy, has aged poorly for many reasons. You think? Whitewashing history, overly long maudlin sentiments, Butterfly McQueen. But damn if it still doesn't pack a wallop due to the performance of Vivian Leigh as Scarlett O'Hara. God damn it, I can't argue with that. Leigh secured the role after the biggest, most publicized, never-to-be-equaled casting call Hollywood ever put out. And no one can ever say it wasn't the right choice. Leigh made the part her own and turns what could have been an absolute career-destroying disaster, cartoonish ditz bitch. Ditz bitch. I have never heard that. I'm going to call everyone a ditz bitch from now on.
I wonder who number one's going to be on that list.
Shut up, you ditz bitch. And into an evocative and captivating character study. A coddled debutante focused solely on parties and frivolities must grow up, adapt and survive as her whole world is destroyed.
You forgot improve.
Yep. Lie, steal, cheat, kill. Boy, does she ever.
Crush, kill, destroy. Never,
yep, and never apologizes for it. Even the sweet, idealistic Melanie Wilkes admires her. Rhett Butler is captivated by her liveliness and independence and only leaves when he realizes he'll never truly tame her. Is she a failure as a wife or is he a failure as a man? Ask his ears. In the end, Scarlett, temporarily set back by this abandonment, gives her final monologue about returning to Tara and making plans to win her husband back. Tomorrow is another day, she says. Or, more simply, I will win.
I thought you were going to say, or is it?
Scarlett always wins. There can be no alternative. And for that, Katie Scarlett O'Hara Hamilton Kennedy Butler earns cinematic immortality and my vote. I'll also add Melanie Wilkes to my list. Really?
All she does is have a baby and die.
One of the many things I love about Gone with the Wind is Scarlett's relationship with Melanie. The sweet, optimistic Wilkes is beloved by everyone who meets her. It's a delicate role and could have easily drowned in easy melodrama, especially since Scarlett's enduring conflict is her futile love of Melanie's husband. But they really do become best friends. Melanie represents the sympathy and humanity Scarlett sometimes lacks in her "it's all about me" mentality, while Scarlett brings Melanie down to earth when she gets too precious for her own good. It is never explicitly stated, but they seem to sense an inherent strength and resilience in one another and respect each other because of that. We think of Scarlett's strong moments, midwifing Melanie's son, driving the cart, keeping just ahead of Sherman's march, and shooting the Yankee soldier burglar in the face. But it's easy to forget that Melanie gave birth as the city around her burned. Melanie was in the back of that cart, keeping a baby alive even though she could barely stay conscious herself because of the pain. And it was Melanie who appeared at the top of the stairs seconds after the shooting with a sword in hand, stating with dry eyes, "I'm glad you killed him," and then suggests they rob the still bleeding corpse's pockets. It is Scarlett and Melanie that have the most compelling relationship in Gone with the Wind, and I argue it's among the most deep and complex in cinema. Oof, wow.
All I have to say is that I don't Monday through Friday know nothing about birthing no Monday through Friday babies.
Samuel Jackson is Prissy, Gone with the Wind.
That was quite an essay.
That really was. Yikes. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. The words of Scarlett O'Hara, "There can be only one."
That was not, in fact, Scarlett O'Hara. That was Highlander.
Oh, I get confused.
I understand why. It's all the sword fights.
Well, thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Billy Boy. And from the far off Emerald Isle, we now head to the snow-covered peaks of Mount Canada. And Vince.
Mount Canada. They only have one mountain, but it is a big one, I'll say. Okay.
I have to say Louise Brooks as Lulu in Pandora's Box.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sure, that was going to be my guess. The Pabst silent film is on the top of my list. Okay. Her performance inspired the look of flappers and Art Deco art for decades, and we still see hints of her in current films today. A more modern character might be Ripley in Aliens, who is by far the most competent person on that spaceship and the only one who might realistically survive the monster. I loved her in the first two movies in that franchise.
Yeah.
That is an important distinction, Vince. And Very well put. I gotta find this movie, Pandora's Box. Apparently it's on streaming.
Oh, yeah, silent film.
And,
oh dear. Is that the red light blinking again?
You can excuse yourself now,
haven't I unscrewed that thing?
I need some private time with my little cuddle pup, Doris Heppelmeyer.
Cuddle pup? Oh, God.
Talk to me, Doris. Talk to me slow.
Hello, Max Mike Movies. Hi, Max. This is Doris Simplemeyer here to answer this week's poll question, which just happens to be, who's your favorite female cinematic character? Well, I got lots, but I'll stick with two, because, you know, that should be good. The first one comes from a movie that's all the way back from 1940, and that's Hilde Johnson in His Girl Friday, as played by Rosalind Russell. Here's a woman she's a reporter. She's got her evens with the guys. I mean, she knows her stuff. Okay, so she goes back to Cary Grant. Not ideal, but I really like her. She's really spunky. Spunky is good. The other one I go for is, she doesn't have a last name in this movie, which I think is funny. Her name is Fran in Strictly Ballroom. And it's almost the same thing, because the thing about Fran is, she has hopes and dreams. She's a plain Jane. She, you know, she's not very good. She's a beginner at dancing, but she has dreams, and she believes in her dreams, and she wants the guy to believe in his dreams. And then she's not afraid to tell him off when he's so high and mighty and thinks that she's nothing. And she says, no, I am something, and I'm going to show you. And, you know, and that's really cool. So those are my two answers. I hope you guys have a wonderful week. I know Maxwell. I'll see you later, Max. And I can't wait to hear next week's episode. Bye.
Oh, Hilde Johnson is awesome. Rosalind Russell and Cary Grant.
Oh, that sounds like a terrible pairing. Who'd want to see them?
They are awesome together.
His Girl Friday? Oh, yeah, nobody ever saw that. It was a big bomb.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Didn't get remade or anything.
Oh,
yeah,
I haven't seen it.
Fran, oh, yes, from Strictly Ballroom.
This was when she just finally erupts in that little Spanish thing, which is the life lived in fear is a life half lived, which goes throughout the whole thing.
And we would both like to emphasize, there are no new steps.
Stips.
Stips. STIPS.
Yes. Thank you, Doris. And Max, there's a little bit of a lot of drool you might want to.
But thank you very much. These were terrific answers, everybody. Fascinating stuff. But what about you, Mike? Who's your favorite female cinematic character?
That's tough. There's so many. Yeah. It was an unfair question. I know. Ripley is obviously.
What kind of jerk would ask that? Oh, right.
A jerk like you, but not you. That's who. Mm-hmm. So I do like Ripley a lot. I loved the fact that she was just competent and got things done, and she saves the cat, which, quite honestly, that's a big point in her favor.
That speaks very well for her.
But although she only had one churn at this character, it was Emily Blunt in Rinse, Die, Repeat, whatever. Same thing.
A perfectly, tomorrow,
yeah, it, perfect. It still sounds like a soap opera. This week
it does.
On Edge of Tomorrow, is the baby hers? Yeah, I really liked the fact that she too was a very capable character that we didn't have to go through that. Well, she's a good warrior. For a woman, crap. Mm-hmm. She was just good. She was in charge. She was focused. We, of course, have to switch that focus to Tom Cruise because he's... I mean, there's tons of other people. I also really love Reggie in Charade. Oh, yeah. It's such a... And even though the pairing is awkward at the least, it still kind of works.
Oh, Dad. I mean, honey.
Yeah. I mean, there's just tons. I just really wanted to bring focus around to women characters because they don't get nearly enough of it. And we so often overlook when they're, because they're so often given little to do. I've been re-listening to our episodes. I cannot tell you how many times we are listing the cast and it's like, well, she's good, except she's given nothing to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I really wanted to ask because I wanted to find some people to bring some stuff up. But what about you, Max? Name some of yours or one of your favorite women characters.
Well, I do have to go along with the others who say Ripley. Ripley is awesome.
Yeah.
But you know the one I really like is one we never actually see, and that's Samantha from Her.
Oh,
you know, Scarlett Johansson as the computer voice. I thought Samantha was a fascinating character.
Hmm.
I thought she was really cool. And it's amazing to see her grow and develop, and we don't see her. She's just a voice.
Oh, also Michelle Yeoh in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Oh,
there's such a dichotomy in there of like how much she wants to do stuff with Chow Yun-fat, but she's responsible for this crazy, unfocused power that steals her, steals the Green Destiny. Yeah, I mean, Michelle Yeoh in anything, honestly.
Yeah, pretty much. Matter.
I don't think I've literally, well, there's this one 80s cop movie she was in where it's like, that's Michelle Yeoh.
The one with Cynthia Rothrock.
But other than that, I'll watch Michelle Yeoh in anything. Anything, anywhere, all at once. So.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah.
But those are great answers, and we want more for this next question.
Ooh.
Now, you must answer, and you must answer immediately and honestly. What is your favorite martial arts movie?
Yeah. Specifically martial arts-based movie.
Oh, martial arts. Now, you want to make a case that American boxing is a martial art? Okay, I'll go for that. Okay. But it's got to be a movie focusing on martial arts.
Okay.
And at the end of the show, we will read the sacred scroll that will tell you the proper way to answer the question.
Ancient Chinese secret, huh?
Mm-hmm. But now...
the facts.
Budget. No clue. No idea. I can't find anything. And part of this movie, Sanshiro Sugata, I'm going to have to say it a few times because I have never heard of this movie. Ever.
Nope, me neither.
And it was made in 1943, where there was kind of some other stuff going on in Japan at the time. So a lot of information either didn't get recorded or was not released.
Yeah, that was one of my first notes was, how is this made in the middle of World War II? But okay.
Yeah. To give you an idea, this movie has been remade 5 times between 1955 and 1977, and twice turned into TV series, 1970 and 1977.
Huh.
Kurosawa also did a sequel to it in 1945, cleverly called Sanshiro Sugata Part 2.
Do we find out where he goes? Because that was one of my questions. Like, where are you going?
He went to Yokohama.
But why? Well, we'll come back to that.
Huh? Yes. As they tell us at the beginning of this movie, the Criterion Collection tells us 1,845 feet of footage was cut in 1944 in accordance with Japanese wartime entertainment policies. No one has ever been able to recover it.
Oh.
This movie is about 80 minutes long. It's supposed to be 97.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I have a question about that in my notes, so we'll come back to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that. The book, this is based on a book called Sanshiro Sugata, was written by Tsuneo Tomita, who was, at the time of the book release, a 38-year-old judo master turned novelist. The Sanshiro character was sculpted around Tsuneo's teacher and celebrated judo expert, Shiro Saigo. So, based on a real person, sort of.
I actually thought it might have been historically a real person, but I guess not.
Though the film made it past the military censors, Kurosawa described the evaluation process as very similar to being on trial.
Oh, dear.
When asked about his experience filming this movie, Kurosawa said, "I simply enjoyed it. I went to sleep each night looking forward eagerly to the next day's shooting, and there was absolutely nothing painful in the experience. The whole task was carried out with a feeling of ease."
Neat.
Well, aren't you special?
Damn you for enjoying your job?
It's kind of refreshing. You hear about all these, "Oh God, this was agony. It was terrible. I had to fight the studio." It's like, no, this was great. Good for you.
During World War II.
World War II. There's a little more on that later. The cinematographer, Akira Mimura, recollected in his diary that the outdoor scene of Master Yano, this is right near the beginning of the film, fighting the gang of jujitsu men.
Yeah.
By the riverside, it was almost 0 degrees.
Oh.
And all the men thrown in the river one by one had to be immediately pulled out of the water and driven back to the hotel to warm up. That's why you don't see them again. That's why you don't see them getting out of the water and you don't hear them splashing or yelling. It's just, "Get me out! Get me out! Get me out!"
Yeah, I kind of wonder, were we supposed to think they died? Whatever. That's fine. We'll come back to that and other things.
Kurosawa loved the book. He begged Toho Pictures to buy the rights for him to make this movie even before the book was officially released. The producer, Nobuyoshi Morita, told him, "We can't buy the rights until the book's officially published." According to Kurosawa himself, He stalked bookstores until he finally found a copy, which he bought and read immediately, and then sent over to Morita that day.
How did he know that it was coming out if it hadn't been published?
No clue.
Ah.
Kurosawa is also credited, along with Tomita, as the writer of this movie, because he adapted the screenplay himself, and he claims he did it in one sitting.
Well,
yeah,
we'll come back to that, too.
Now, the information section of the Japanese Navy, just after the success of this movie, apparently it was a success, I have no numbers on that,
yeah,
approached Kurosawa about making a film focusing on zero fighter pilots. That seems weird, you know, why wouldn't you want to have some fighter pilots?
It's not just the name of a plane.
Oh, right. Due to the budget issues at this stage in the war, which I think meant instead of planes, they would have had to use paper airplanes or shadow puppets or something. Mm-hmm. He did, however, make a movie called The Most Beautiful in 1944, which is, this sounds like a real barn burner, female volunteer workers at an optics plant who do their best to meet production targets.
The does motion that picture.
Ever, does that ever sound like wartime propaganda movies?
No,
yikes!
Oh, I'm sure there's love and history and a twist at the end. Okay.
This film was not released in the West until 1974, and in most markets it was under the name Judo Saga.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
And the climactic fight scene was originally planned to be filmed on a stage set with painted clouds and large wind fans. Kurosawa really didn't like the look, and he got permission from the studio for 3 more days doing outdoor location. Day 3 delivered the huge windstorm used in the final footage.
Cool, we'll come back to that.
Yep. There isn't a lot else about that, unless you know I have something?
No. I mean, I looked a little into Kurosawa, who's a very interesting character, not least of which that we kind of owe our exposure to Godzilla to him, because in 1950, Rashomon won the prize at the, I think it was the Venice Film Festival, or one of the big ones, mm-hmm. and they were like, oh, maybe there's something worth something in these Japanese films, and then, like, literally 2 years later, Godzilla came out, so, you know. But lots of other things. Apparently, at various times in his career, he was at, well, he was trying to break into Western film. Apparently, there was a lot of issues with working within the system in Japan, which we've heard before in some of other films. And his breakout film was supposed to be Tonight in the Movie Loft, Tora, Tora, Tora.
I thought he did direct that.
He did not. He was supposed to direct the Japanese half of that. But partway into production, they all thought he was actually insane and had him taken to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist basically said, he's just really tired. So just leave him alone. He can't work. He shouldn't work. And so he bowed out. So somebody else directed it.
Dang.
And his name was taken out, although they still used his script. I'd look into that. But and he had a real dry period for a while until Star Wars came out, which is...
Hey, that's Hidden Fortress, you bastard!
It's not. If you've seen Hidden Fortress, they're not the same. It is influenced by it, which, which Lucas fully admits, and he is a big fan of Kurosawa. And Kurosawa's like, hey, I kind of want to do another movie, and I'd really like if it was something that was successful. And he helped get Kagamusha made, which is kind of cool. So, yeah, just a little. There's tons in more. Yeah. But just anyway,
he's a fascinating character.
Tell us this Japanese tale, won't you?
I shall tell you the plot.
And don't do that voice.
And I will do it in authentic Japanese.
No, you won't.
No, I won't.
Judo. You don't.
Sanshiro Sugata has a plan. He will come to unnamed 19th century Japanese town, search down movie set lane, and find an instructor who will teach him the ways of jujitsu. He finds one. That's good. But the instructor is a brutal lout who drinks and gambles. That's bad. But apparently there's a new judo master nearby. That's good. But Sugata's new teacher wants to go and ambush him and beat him up because jujitsu rules and judo drools. That's bad. But hey-ho, Kokomo, the judo master, Mr. Yano, handily clobbers the lout and his loutettes. Not being a complete moron, Sugata becomes his rickshaw driver. Because that's how you study judo. Apparently. Sugata goes on to become super best excellent judo fighting man. That's a very rough translation.
Very.
But he only sees judo as a way to beat people up, which annoys Master Yano. Apparently, to truly grok judo, one must understand humanity. Student Ed Gruberman is so frustrated, he throws himself into a pond, intent on moistening himself to death. But in the water, he is inspired by the sight of a perfect lotus blossom, and suddenly understands humanity, because lotus blossoms can do that. Sugata later ends up in a match where he defeats, and sort of kills, another jujitsu master. This deeply upsets the lovely Sayo, for some reason. She now hates Sugata and wants him dead. That's bad. And lurking nearby is the great jujitsu expert Genosuke Hagaki, coward, bully, cad, and thief. We know he's a bad guy because he exclusively wears Western clothes. Boo!
Yes.
Hagaki wants to fight Sugata, but he knows he has to wait until the final scene or we won't have no picture. Along the way, Sugata has to fight Master Murai, the father of Sayo. But Sugata has fallen in love with Sayo because she prays a lot and he fixed her shoe. Look, just go with it!
True.
Sugata defeats Master Murai, but managed to not completely murder him, and now they're pals. But now he must fight Hagaki. He wins, and now they're pals. Then he has to go to Yokohama for some reason. The end. The moral, beating someone in a judo versus jujitsu match means you're pals. Thank you.
The film.
I hate to say this, but you're, for the most part, your little reenactment there is accurate.
Yeah. Again, it is kind of frustrating. They put notes in the movie and tell you, there's 18 minutes missing here, and every so often it's like, now this happens.
Yeah.
And now, I think it's twice, that you, this is what happens that you can't see.
Yeah.
And this is what happens that you can't see.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that.
I really wish we'd seen, because it's really confusing.
Well, it's not, well, we'll get back to that. We have to do the, well, we're going to, I guess, briefly do the cast first.
Yeah, we'll do some of the cast.
Let's be fair. We don't speak Japanese. It's
no,
hard
we're
for
not
us
really
to
qualified
really
to judge
gauge, the performances, yeah. But,
The one they tend to start off with is Denjiro Okochi, who is Master Yano, Shogoro Yano.
Yeah.
He is very much the kind of standard, yes, I am the master.
Yeah.
I have much wisdom. I will stand here and glower.
I am. Yeah, but he's obviously very, he's a kind-hearted person, too. I love the fact that when he is first set upon by the bad guys, and he's just like being rickshawed through town, he's basically like, okay, do you really want to do this? And after he throws the first guy in the river, he's still like, he's not attacking anybody. He's actually standing right near the river, which, having seen the first bad guy thrown into it, you might take a clue that this is not a good thing.
No, these guys do not learn quickly, because none of them are even a challenge for him.
Well, my favorite of the bad guys is the bad guy named Mama.
And it's Manma. They wrote it wrong.
Okay, because it's like, oh no, I'm going to be attacked by Mama. No, Mama, no.
Mama, no!
Yeah, no, see, he is that wizened master of the martial arts that only fights when he has no other choice and does not seek to kill people. Although, because of this whole cold water thing, I'm like, did they all die? Did he literally just kill six guys? Like, luckily, they kind of sort of show up later, so, but you've forgotten who they were by that point, so it doesn't really matter. So, yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we then have Susumi Fujita as our hero, Sanshiro Sugata.
Yeah.
He's fine. You know, brave and true, eyes of, well, not blue, but
yeah,
it's a black and white movie. The thing is, there's a lot, I don't know if we're supposed to be able to deduce it or if it's in the missing footage. The thing that struck me was at the end, and this is jumping ahead to the final scene before the duel with Hagaki, he's standing in the field singing at the top of his lungs.
Yeah.
We have never seen him sing, not once in this movie, until that point. I'm like, whoa, is this what he does? That's cool.
Yeah, well, he's singing Into the Wind, too.
Yeah.
So I want to say that I think that one of the chunks where there's literally a chunk of the film that's missing where a play card comes up and says, And after that, he learned valuable lessons, went off and matured. But we have no time for that now. Let's, in fact, go back here. And there's this, like, the most important part, I think, of the character's development has been cut out for reasons I can't even begin to understand. And it makes it very difficult because he is a very changed character when he comes back. We just are told he's changed now.
Okay.
I'll go with that. So, sure, he's fine. I mean,
yeah. And there's like the dad, Sayamurai, who is played by Yukiko Todoroki, and you know he is the opponent, and really wants to fight because there's a big thing. We'll get to this. The rivalry between the style of school of jujitsu and the schools of Shotokan judo.
Yeah,
and he exists.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, it's nothing much to his character.
There is, though, because there is that point. He is the he is the head of the, I guess, the bad guys or the jujitsu. I mean, they're not really bad guys. They're just sort of, you know, the thugs. Local thugs.
Yeah.
And he really feels that he needs to make this fight. He needs to fight Sugata, and, you know, that's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that you can tell from his performance that his confidence is there, but there's sort of this shroud around them that's like, yeah, no, you're older. This is really a young man's game, and as expertise and your skills are not going to be enough. And his daughter is praying for him, which I think is one of the reasons we know what's likely going to happen. I do like the fact that afterwards he is totally defeated, and he realizes that he's totally defeated.
Yeah, he's lost hard, and he gives up.
But he also, like, steps into a new part or a new time of his life, and he becomes friends with Sanshō Sugata, and it's actually kind of touching. They actually get along very well. So
he has more backstory that we just don't know about. I mean, apparently he was a drunk, and he stopped drinking and rehoned his skills so he could fight Sugata, apparently.
Everybody has backstory we don't know about.
Yeah, and that we don't, or sometimes we hear someone mention it, but we don't see anything.
Or it's on a little card in Japanese, and we have to assume that the nice Criterion people are telling us what it actually says. But I think he does have a little depth to him that even we can appreciate.
Sorry, I actually got that name wrong. What? Yukiko Todoroki plays Sayo, his daughter.
Yeah, I thought so. I was like, why are you... I think you mean Takashi Shimura, who plays... Him. Yeah.
Yep, sorry. I have tried... I have trouble with Japanese names sometimes.
Good luck with the next
one. I can pronounce them. It's hard to connect them to people for me.
Well, you can pronounce them the way the Westerner does, because they pronounce it differently. But,
true.
Ryunosuke Kigata, who plays the bad guy, or Ryunosuke Higaki. Very bad, very evil.
Very, very evil. You know this because he has facial hair and he always wears Western clothes. This is a trope in a lot of Japanese cinema. You could almost always peg the bad guy because he wears a suit.
Well, now let's be fair. I think there is a lot of suggestion in this film about the influence of Western culture and how it's perceived. Yeah. And
that is a big theme.
I think I don't know this for sure. Dave will correct us if we're wrong.
Yeah.
But I think there were people in Japan at the time when we showed up, because it was the Americans in like 1860, somebody showed up and said, "You must open your borders." Just like that episode of Speed Racer.
That's right, Kapetepec analog.
You must open your borders. So I think that there were a lot of people who were like, cool, something new, let's glom on to this. And there was a lot of traditionalists that were basically of the opposite opinion, like, this is something that's changing our culture and it's not good, it's a bad thing. And who knows,
we'll get back to that too.
Might even have been a reason for entering World War II. I don't know. But Higaki is a perfect visual representation of bad Western influence, haughty, skilled martial artist. I'm going to take you down. And that is all there is to him.
Pretty much. We get hints that there's something else. Maybe he has an interest in Sayo. We don't know.
He seems to. That's the best we can go. But he basically shows up and says, your judo stinks. I know six types of kung fu. And I'm going to take you down, Sugata. Okay.
I do have to say about Tsukigata is he has real presence.
Yeah.
He's really menacing often just by standing there and looking. And that's really easy to do and look silly.
The problem, I have to say, is that that's most of his character.
That is almost all of his character.
Until there's a fight.
Standing there and looking menacing until the fight, yeah.
In a suit. Can you? I need to hire you. Do you look menacing in a suit? I do.
Except he doesn't. Uh-huh. When he's fighting, he's wearing traditional clothes. Right. He's not wearing the suit.
Yeah, anyway, we're going to come back to
clothes. Those are most of the main characters. Honestly, I kind of like the priest. He's cool, but we'll get to him.
He's almost comic relief, almost. But
oh, yeah.
We're hampered by the fact that we don't know the language and the culture, so we're doing our best. And there was nobody that stood out to me that said, wow, what is going on with them? Is there something wrong here? Everybody's fine.
Yeah.
We know you haven't seen this before because you said so, and because of the opening that you gave for the show.
Yep.
I will never forget
you. Well,
yes,
but obviously I'm an expert on the history of judo. So now, by the way, that is a real thing. Jiu-jitsu goes back to the 8th century. It is old. The samurai were taught it for unarmed combat. Judo showed up in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. It's not even 200 years old.
Yeah.
So it was considered kind of the upstart whippersnapper of martial arts. I can give you the most surface idea of what the difference is between the two.
Really? Wow, but, that's a surprise. Well,
yeah, ain't that a shock? Yeah. Jiu-jitsu, they focus mostly on holds, throws, and joint locks. There aren't a lot of strikes.
Mm-hmm.
Judo tends to be, as I understand it, which is not very well, more oriented as a sport.
Oh.
And that is one of the things that people, a lot of the jiu-jitsu folks, don't like about it. There's apparently a Brazilian form of jiu-jitsu, and they and the judo people loathe each other.
Is that capoeira?
No, I don't know why. No, it's actually, I don't know.
Capoeira is really fun to watch. Dear gods, it's amazing. It's like breakdancing that kills
different.
People.
No, that's more kicks and strikes. I'm betting it's cool. Same, but I can't say. Oh, it looks awesome because it was disguised as a dance.
Ah.
Because they weren't allowed to study, the Brazilian folk, the peasants, weren't allowed to study how to fight. So they had to hide and say, oh no, we're dancing. This is all dance practice.
Just like that episode of Batman where he's going to have his little pebbles dropped on his head, then he does the Batusi, but then he really fights the bad guys. Yeah.
Exactly.
So I wonder if that's not part of the other theme, though, which is the... We're looking at the Western influence and the new being the bad, but judo in this case is being the new that's being good. I wonder if it's done that way on purpose to provide contrast. I don't know.
It might very well be.
I do have a question.
Yes.
I know you're not an expert in judo, as should be obvious. Does judo require clothing?
Yes. What do you mean require? People usually wear a gi like they do in most of the martial arts.
I know, but I'm watching this, and every time the judo stuff starts, somebody has to grab somebody's shirt, and I'm like, what if he hasn't got a shirt? Now what do you do?
I noticed that. I also, because in a lot of modern martial arts matches, you know, like Olympic karate or Olympic judo, you're not supposed to grab the other guy's clothing. That's kind of cheating.
Well, so I kind of wonder. It's like, can you walk up to a guy who's going to do judo and you just take your shirt off? Oh, he wins. I mean, I don't know.
I'm betting there are other techniques that don't require clothing. Yeah. So we know this takes place in 1882. This is full-on Meiji period.
Yeah.
The power of the emperor has been restored. The shogun's been reduced to basically opening shopping centers or the equivalent.
Okay.
And this is when, as you say, this is one of the conflicts, because one of the big conflicts in the Meiji period was, do we open up our borders to the West? Do we allow trade with the West?
And the only way you can do it is if you have a race where your racer and their racer come together, and whoever's racer wins. Oh, I'm sorry, that's Speed Racer again.
I am so embarrassed by the fact that when in the match between Murai and Sugata, we keep hearing Sayo's voice, Father will win. And all I kept thinking was, Kabbalah will win!
See?
I apologize. I'm so sorry to all people of Japan everywhere.
Yeah, I think it's called the Fire Race. It's a two-parter if you want to look it up on Shout TV. But yeah. So, fighting.
This is the big thing. The big thing was the opening of the borders and this influx of Western goods and Western ideas. And a big thing, the way it's represented in most movies visually, is the clothes.
Right.
And the fact that, you know, some of them... That's the other thing Higaki does. He smokes cigarettes.
Ooh.
That is often the mark of the bad guy in a lot of movies. Not always, but very often.
Well, let's take a look at Kurosawa's directorial style here. I don't know about you. I don't know how much you've ever seen of it, but I've got a bunch of Kurosawa. Well, I don't mean about Kurosawa. I've actually seen a little bit of Bunraku, No, and Kabuki, and I really felt there was a lot of that tradition in his staging. I felt that a lot of the poses are very sort of water flowy and then snap too. There's a lot of this. There's a lot of, in some cases, exaggerated movement or exaggerated expressions, which just sort of naturally fell into the way this story is told. Did you notice this, and did it feel strange to you?
Not really, because I kind of expect that from him, because he loves doing that. Even the little things, like when Sugata first shows up and he's walking down the alley and the women are teasing him. I think it's right out of, and I'm going to get these mixed up, out of Kabuki theater, where there is there's either a single narrator or almost a chorus of like a couple of people saying, oh, you are looking for so-and-so, you will find him there, but you will not find... That was very, like, traditional theater to me.
Oh, dear gods. And, of course, it is echoed in the Mikado by Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the Mikado is, we're a bunch of English colonizers, and this is what we think Japanese are like.
Yeah. The clue, no, that's not. But, yeah, and there's also these wonderful, long, slow pans over characters' faces, something that Kurosawa likes to do. He's very into mood, and this is not uncommon in the Japanese films that I've seen, where you will get, especially the end where we're at that windy mountain, we're just like looking at the wind ripping at these weeds and their grass or whatever it is, and we're looking at the clouds. It is all about setting the mood. And I think mood is a very important part of this film, not least of which because all the backstory's been cut out. And I felt that a lot of times expression, camera angles, and that really that focus on where you are and what the surroundings feel like was used a lot to help get the story apart. What do you think?
Definitely. Kurosawa loves reaction shots. He loves showing people's faces, not necessarily what's happening, but how they're seeing it.
Yeah.
Like they're the proxies for the audience or some such. Yeah, I think that absolutely, and he is very into mood.
Yeah.
And he doesn't use a lot of music for it. It's all the lighting and the way the angles are shot.
Yeah. There's a couple of metaphors he does that are really interesting. Early on, we see this thing where Sugata has basically taken the place of the rickshaw driver, because the rickshaw driver quite smartly has said, oh, a big martial arts fight? I'm going home now, and leaves.
Yeah, bye!
So he takes over, and I think this is meant to show his humbleness, right? He's almost prostrating himself. He says, I would like to learn from you and to show you that I'm serious. I will even start off as your rickshaw driver. And he realizes that those traditional wooden sandals that Japanese wear are not going to work as a rickshaw driver. So he casts them aside. We then follow the shoe as it travels through time, which is a way of letting us know, hey, he's training.
Time has passed.
Yeah, we don't need to focus on this.
No martial arts montage, no, Rocky music or anything. I do have in my notes, so now this is the story of a poor lost shoe as it makes its desperate bid for freedom down the river. Farewell, shoe.
Well, of course, the sad part is it never meets up with its mate again, so it's a very tragic story.
It will be alone, but we are all alone. Yeah, no, it's a...
The film was called Five Toes.
Imagistically, I think it works really well.
Yeah, there's another one later on where he is that big fight where he kills the guy. And all we see is we're sitting there wondering, the guy has been thrown across the room. I think there were wires.
I'm going to get back to that. But the wall, he hit the wall so hard it broke.
So we don't know. But then there is this slow motion bit where one of the rice paper panels above him falls. And it's he's dead. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we can tell that is a symbol that, just so you know, I'm not going to come out and say he died. I'm just going to do this, which I appreciated. I liked the poetry of that instead of, everyone screaming and crying. Yeah. The big question I have is later on when Sayo first sees Sugata, because at one point she has stopped trying to kill him. She has a knife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She doesn't recognize him. And I'm like,
Yeah. There's a whole sequence after he kills this guy who apparently is important to her.
I don't think it was that. I think it was the brutality. I think that's what...
No.
I think that she was just shocked by the fact that this bout, this demonstration ended in a death. I think that was a shocking thing. That's my feeling.
I also think it because he represented judo defeating jiu-jitsu, and her dad is the head of the big jiu-jitsu school in the town. Yeah, but she's looking right at him. I mean, we get a long close-up, a long shot of her staring with intense hatred at Sugata, who she promptly forgets.
Well, she forgets what he looks like because she's wanted to kill him, which is a really weird reaction. Like, you caused somebody's death. I'm going to kill you. That part I found a little confusing.
And then she goes and prays it out.
Yeah. You know, to whatever ancestor or could have been.
It's a Shinto shrine. Yeah.
Yeah, because there's spirits.
It wouldn't be
things.
An ancestor. Yeah. It wouldn't be an ancestor shrine. That's usually in the home, I think.
I don't know enough. I wouldn't want to guess. Yeah. I do know that Shintos are generally natural spirits of some sort.
Yeah.
I will say, I mean, Kurosawa was a brilliant director, did some amazing films. But the third note I made, and this is as soon basically as Sugata and his new gang show up, my third note of this film was, feels like the new pupil will jump ship and fall in love with the daughter.
Yeah.
Did you feel that?
I knew he was going to jump ship. I mean, you see that immediately when he looks around disapprovingly at his new teacher and they're drinking and gambling, which is wrong, Nell. I knew that part. The falling in love with the daughter, I mostly thought because, well, she's the only female character who gets more than one line. So,
yeah
he's going to fall in love with her.
I just was like, I was amazed at how telegraphed that was.
Yeah, that was a little surprising. I'm wondering if that was part of the time. It's like, or part of a, you must have a romance in here. You can't just have people fighting, gotta have romance.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but I wonder if it was just that we are usually expecting to be surprised or letting things unfold, and maybe it's just a different style of storytelling where that's not how the Japanese do it, that foreshadowing is expected. I don't know, but it's a foreign film I've never seen before, and it 5 minutes in and I know what's going to happen. I was like, that's interesting. Yeah. So I did want to bring up the Lotus real quick, because at one point Sanshiro Sugata decides, oh, I have shamed my master and I am terrible. I am going to kill myself by standing in a puddle. And I was
he jumps
like,
in a pond and he's holding on to some sort of a stake or
supposedly,
something.
I don't buy it for an instant. If he lets go of the stake, he'll be sucked under by the mud. And I'm like, okay, you could will yourself to die, but quite honestly, the only way you're dying is by starvation. That's just, but he sees this lotus and I'm like, okay, this is important. What does this mean? So I looked it up. And apparently the lotus has, of course, many meanings, different cultures, etc. But
big thing in Buddhism.
Yeah. It can mean the purity of spirit, which I think applies. Yeah. It can refer to a renaissance or religious reincarnation, which I think applies. And it can apply towards enlightenment, which I
also
think
applies.
The problem is the only way he's going to die in this film is by exposure, and the lotus is a summer flower, and it only lasts 4 days. But it's one of those times where you can tell this is important, and the flower's telling you everything, but as Westerners, we don't want to know what it is. So I'm glad I looked it up. I kind of got the idea anyway. How about you?
I got the idea. I thought it was actually very clear.
Okay.
He's looking at it and he sees how perfect the flower. I mean, what I was seeing is, look, the flower is so perfect. It's in the middle of all this conflict and it is just there. And that's how he gains insight into humanity. I actually kind of liked Master Yano's thing after, you know, basically Sugata has gotten into a fight with the town and has beaten up the town.
Yeah.
And as he says, you're very strong. You're stronger than I am. Mm-hmm. You're an incredibly powerful warrior, but you don't get judo at all because you don't understand humanity.
Mm-hmm.
There's no empathy with you. You just think it's a weapon. And he says it's like giving a knife to a lunatic. It's like, that's actually a pretty good analogy.
Yeah.
It's the idea that, to you, this is just something to hurt people. It's also about other things. It's about understanding what connects us. It's about peace. It's about focus. I think that's a really interesting message, and that he gets it by through pain and through suffering. Very Catholic. And
yeah, no other religion does that.
Nah, yeah.
Forgot guilt. Yeah, that's a good point. And I definitely agree.
I do want to talk about the last scene. Well, it's not the last scene. It's it should be. It's the final fight.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant the one with the darling little train. Wasn't it cute?
Oh, that locomotive is adorable. It's so cute. It's like, oh, you're the little engine that could.
It was. It was. I think it's like, how are you pulling more than two people? It's so small, but okay.
I think they all have to get out and push.
Yeah. But the big fight scene.
When Sugata and Higaki are fighting, that scene is just visually really cool. They're out on this field.
Amazing.
The wind blowing the tall grass. And the thing I think that is most interesting about a lot of these fights is it's not the fight. It's not the actual combat that is the interesting part, which makes sense for judo and jiu-jitsu, because to people who aren't experts like us,
yeah,
we don't really, it doesn't look like that much. Like, oh, he just twisted and pushed the guy or flipped this guy over. It's all about the feel, the mood, like you said. Even the stuff when he's fighting Murai, and at first it looks like they're waltzing. Because they're just holding on to each other and moving side to side. And in this, so much of it is the two just looking at each other, and then there's a brief move and then a counter move. We don't see very much. A lot of it's happening in the grass. But we see the reactions of the people. We see the clouds and the wind.
Well, it's like that old story we've heard about the two samurai who meet on the bridge only big enough for one. And they stand there, and after a few minutes, if I remember correctly, and I'm probably not, one of them steps aside because they've already done the battle in their minds. They can tell each other's skill.
Yeah, they've already known. It's like, oh, I'm going to lose.
Yeah. Okay. And you get the idea that that's the kind of thing going on here, except, of course, they still go through with the fight. It is also very visually poetic, and the wind in the mountains is amazingly powerful. I'm glad that he took those 3 days to do it, because, like, watching that on a set, it would have just been, like, you could see somebody's hand with some grass in it going, that would have been terrible.
Whoosh, I guess.
Yeah, but, look at the time. Speaking of wind... We better blow our way to the final part of the show.
You say, calling me a windbag?
Yes.
The finish.
So, Max.
Yeah.
Never seen it, never heard of it.
Nope. Didn't even know it existed.
Now, what Kurosawa films have you seen? I'm betting there's a small handful.
Let's see. I saw, Yojimbo and the sequel, Sanjuro. Seen Kagamusha, Seven Samurai, Rashomon.
Did you see Ron?
I saw Ron 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Never saw Throne of Blood. I kept meaning to.
Me either. I have seen High and Low, though, which is also a really good film. Yeah.
I haven't seen that. How about you?
All the ones you mentioned plus High and Low. And there was one other one, but I can't remember its title right now. So this was his first film. What did you think of Sanshiro Sugata?
Considering, again, this is his first movie ever as a director. He'd been a second director a few times, like an associate director. I think it's pretty impressive, especially when you consider this is a friggin' martial arts film. This is of a genre and an era where it's like, ha, we will fight now. Yes, I will fight you too. Ha ha. Fortunately, no Australian accents. I know those were the Hong Kong movies, not the Japanese ones. But you get some of the Japanese movies where they got the same, I swear to God, the same three Australian voice actors.
Or, of course, Akisaki, ha!
Ha! Exactly. But
that's the Flintstones.
I mean, again, it's also very frustrating because you can see where the chunks of the movie were taken out.
Well, they label them.
I really wanted to see what was in them because I think it would have really helped. So it's kind of frustrating that way. And in some ways, like, okay, he's doing a lot of the very standard martial arts movie tropes. Like you pointed out, he's going to go to the nice man, the wise master, and he's going to fall in love with somebody's daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was interesting. It's not his best. Let's make that very clear. But I enjoyed it. What about you? You, likewise, this was brand new to you, right?
Yeah, I didn't know what his first film. I knew Rashomon was one of the earliest, and I saw it when I was in film school, and it was like, That's really interesting. And the sad thing is that with Rashomon, he does something that will then be done by many other people.
Oh, God, so many people.
Which is whatever. But I think that there are parts of this film that are really awkward, not least of which the giant child. I swear it has all these characters and it translates to scene missing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Literally, they tell you, oh, he matured and grew up and learned his lessons. And it's like, could we see any? No. Okay, because we had to cut. I really can't figure out why they cut that out.
And you're right. The ending is really confusing. He ends up on the train with Sayo. And it's like, oh, I have something in my eye. And he starts to fix it. He's like, oh, no, you don't, I bet. And the big romantic gesture is, I'll be back.
Yeah.
Why is he going? We don't know. He had to make a journey. We have no idea why.
Nope.
Why?
He just leaves. That's it.
Yeah.
The ending is very abrupt. And that's why I wondered if it wasn't a historically known character. It's like, oh, everybody knows. Oh, that's Sanshiro Sagata. Everybody knows what he did. And apparently, no, it's from this book. So, there are some very awkward, clunky parts. Apparently, some of them were not Kurosawa's fault. It was literally the censors coming in going, no, you must cut back. No backstory. We don't allow backstory during the war.
It will cause us to lose.
But visually, we've got some real poetic stuff going on here. We have very different ways of doing things. I don't know about you, but I did not miss the montage of him learning martial arts at all. The shoe.
Honestly, I thought the shoe was way more interesting.
Well, you can fill it in because basically it's the director going, you're not an idiot. You know what happens.
Yeah.
And it's fine. The problem I have with the film, too, is that we don't really know enough about the characters. And Sugata is the number one person on that list. And when he does his training and he becomes a bully and a drunk, it's like, why did he do that?
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand.
Made him do that.
Yeah. And I'm glad that he jumps in a puddle and learns a lesson from, listen to the flowers. but I don't, some of that, the motivation I don't get. That being said, there's some gorgeous shots in here. There's some great framing. There's some really interesting use of the camera. And even though we're foreigners, a lot of this we get or we can infer. And even if we're wrong, it still makes sense. Like, it works well. So I think this is a film that says, it's like Robert Rodriguez. He's not there yet exactly, but there's a lot of promise here.
You can see where the potential is. You can just tell.
You know what, Ross, I can see potential is in our poll question. Would you go over that again and tell people how they can answer?
Ah, you have insulted my house by asking me to repeat this. You must die now.
Good luck.
I see you like to chew. Maybe you would like to chew on my fist.
Chew me?
Okay. I like that line from Kung Fu Panda. I just do. Yes, our poll question. What is your favorite martial arts movie? Just that. It's nothing complicated. Which one do you like? Lots of kicking and punching and fighting and...
Yeah. With martial arts
part of the rabbit.
Rabbit.
And how can you answer this question, you may ask? Well, you may ask.
I'm asking.
You can, of course, go to our website at maxmikemovies.com and leave a comment. You can email us directly at us@maxmikemovies.com. You can answer this question. You can give us suggestions. You could tell us that we have insulted your master and we must die now, or that we got something completely wrong about this movie. All sorts of things. Whatever you like. We love it all. You can, of course, see us on the socially facing
Facebook, medias. Blue Sky, and Mastodon. Go on.
Yes, what the reciprocating
I'm
Marva
sorry.
Said over
355 episodes. I am done.
Yeah. Yes, we're there under Max Mike Movies. We're also on all podcast apps throughout time and space. And of course, you can join my little snoogie woogie Doris
or our secret admirer.
Yep, or our mysterious secret admirer. We still don't have any bids for who this might be. Who could it be?
It's not real Julia Roberts, but...
Well, obviously. I mean, you know her voice.
Yeah. You can it's haunting, isn't it?
Call our hotline and leave a comment at 617-398-7266. That's 617-398-7266. And now we come to the final movie in our series, Directors in Short Pants. And that is going to be Mike. Not in short pants. He is going to pick the movie.
Oh, I thought you were saying the movie was going to be called Mike. And it's like, I don't know that movie.
I know there's one called Michael. That's the one with John Travolta as an angel. I don't know
one
called Mike.
No, not doing that.
What are we going to watch?
What Mike? Are we going to watch? What are we going to watch? What are we going to watch? What?
Don't make me hurt you.
I haven't decided yet. The movie we're going to watch next week is...
That you are now going to tell us.
Is that I'm going to tell you. I'm going to drop the name of the film. Is the first film by a director who has made a lot of films.
Okay.
I think... That
Mike doesn't know.
Mike is trying to decide. There's two different films that I would like to choose from, and I haven't quite decided, but it's
hard
now
when
the
it's
time.
The last one.
Yeah. You know,
it's the last
it's like, do we go out on, like, a big, well-known, well-respected director who's somewhat problematic, or do we go out on another director who's well-known and has been kind of all over the board? And I think...
Either one sounds interesting.
It's that time of year. I'm going to go this way. Yeah. This time of year, what are we looking forward to? We're getting into that spooky season. We're getting into that time where people like to be scared. No, people don't like to be scared. Well, some people do, apparently. And apparently one of those people that likes to be scared is best friends with the biggest chin in Hollywood. And
Mighty
what,
Chin?
It is the Mighty Chin. And what film did they make together first? Sam Raimi and The Chin That Roared? Ooh. Why, The Evil Dead. Now,
evil, pure and simple for the eighth dimension.
If you have never seen The Evil Dead, you may say, well, I saw Evil Dead 2. Is that the same series? And the best part of that is sort of. So Evil Dead 2 is kind of a remake of Evil Dead 1. But we're not watching Evil Dead 2. We're watching Evil Dead 1 next week.
Ah, the original, the very first Sam Raimi film.
That's right. And after seeing it, we'll find out if Evil Dead 1.
Oh, I see what you did there. Dun, dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun. Die. Dude.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.